Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 93, book Time Travel, Antiquarian to Digital, a conversation with Michael Mart. Michael was born in Arizona. His family moved to Southern California when he was 5. Graduated from the University of California at Berkeley with a BA in sociology. Spent time doing postgraduate work at Cambridge Goddard Graduate Program in Massachusetts before coming to SUNY Stony Brook to pursue a master's PhD in sociology. In 1972, Michael's wife Mary opened a used bookshop in Port Jefferson on East Main Street, the Good Times Bookshop. Michael was immediately drawn to the business. He halted work on his PhD, devoting full time to the bookshop, never looking back. He and Mary are in the antiquarian book business to this day, even though the bookshop was closed in 2006 after 34 years. His life in bookselling eventually led to an interest in video production and computer technology, all of which helped sustain him in the current period of semi-retirement. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. Welcome, Michael Mart, to Between the Lines. Thanks for being on. How are you today?
Very good. My pleasure to be here.
That's good. I know we've known each other a whole bunch of years, and we've had some interesting phone conversations. I always learn something new from you. You're always kind of thinking ahead of the curve and interest along those lines. And I wanted to start off with an anecdote because it's going to tie into something that, you know, touches on a lot of topics that are along the lines of what you do. One time, you and your wife, Mary, were giving me a ride into the city, and we're both big Bob Dylan fans.
Right.
Now, there's tons of Dylan songs that I have probably not heard, and I know you probably heard far more than I have, but it was in your car that I heard, the first time I heard The Ballad of the Thin Man, and it's a great song, and I wanted to read this stanza first, because it ties into what, then I'll let you go on. You've been with professors, and they've all liked your looks. With great lawyers, you have discussed lepers and crooks. You've been through all of F. Scott Fitzgerald's books. You're really well read. It's well known because something is happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones?
Oh, right.
Now, because you're the type that, you know, really wants to know what's going on in the world, and you want to know, you know, things like that. So it made me think of you, and the segue is kind of like the to talk about books in general and how many people, you know, the types of people at your store that you know, that maybe fit that category where they were so into the books that they didn't have any clue of what was going on in the world.
quite a few.
Well, maybe first give a little bit of background on the Good Times Bookshop in Port Jefferson.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. It started in 1972. I was my wife and I, Mary's my wife, came here to Long Island and Port Jefferson in 1971. I came as a graduate student at Stony Brook in the field of sociology. And we had been living in Berkeley, where I was an undergraduate, and living and working there, and we really like secondhand bookshops. And for those of you, your listeners who know the web host, Moe's Bookshop on Telegraph Avenue was one that we frequented, as did many, many people, and still do, quite regularly. So when we got here, there were no secondhand bookshops. There was a wonderful new bookshop called Corner Bookshop near the university. So my wife had an idea that she would like to open up the shop. We found a location on East Main Street, a building that hadn't been used for a while, contacted the landlord, and made arrangements to rent it. And that was in 72, and then by 74, I sort of lost interest in the field of sociology and the direction in which it was going, and stopped my work on the PhD, and went to the book business full-time. And we were there now for, let's see, 34 years.
Wow.
But it was very unique for this area. Obviously, there hadn't been one specifically devoted to secondhand books. We first started with paperbacks because that's what we were accustomed to. And then in no time at all, we branched out into hardcovers and then years later into rare and scarce books.
Yeah, that's one on your website now. There's that big word. I even had to look it up to make sure I knew what it was.
Yeah,
antiquarian.
Okay. Antiquarian, yeah.
So what type of books fit that category?
Well, books that are usually 100 years older or more.
Okay.
And they're out of print in their... they were generally out of print. There weren't many reprints at that time of those books, as there is now. They were very, very interesting, and there was a really good market here, both for buying on our part and for selling. A lot of old estates here on Long Island that when people were clearing out those estates and they had books of note, I would go and buy them. So it was very it was good for buying here and
right.
for selling as well, although selling was mostly, of those books, was mostly in the city at these book fairs.
Huh.
Yeah, this was all, this time was all pre-internet. And then we had something called AB, the Antiquarian Bookman. And it was a weekly publication, so dealers would list, you know, books for sale or books that they're looking for their customers. And booksellers and collectors would subscribe to it, and we'd go through it and say, write a quote on a book. Well, we have that book. We can sell it to you for $12. And we would describe it, and it would all be done by postcard. So it was a very slow process.
Yeah, amazing. I think,
you know,
pre-internet.
Yeah, it was very pre-internet. And it was a very slow process, but it worked really well because, like with most stores, and certainly today, you would never really be able to sell all of your stock or make a living from your stock based on the number of people who pass through your open door. You know, there just weren't that many book people in this area that could sustain that. So mail order became a very, very important part of our business. And it's now it's exclusively that and on the internet.
Okay. You mentioned that your wife Mary started the store, and then you jumped in. So how was that working? You know, with her, did you each have your each have a different role, or you worked together? I mean, even though you worked together, was it kind of like working alongside each other, or mixing, or
literally,
what?
Literally. I mean, we lived upstairs from the store for 10 years. We were married. We spent all of our time together. And she brought to the shop things that I couldn't. She knew literature better than I did. She knew authors that I didn't know. So she would know, you know, what to stock and what to look for when people brought books in to buy. And she really liked to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked to buy. So I was the one that went out onto the road for the most part. When we would get calls to go into people's homes, to look at their books for sale, I would do that, and really enjoyed it. And on the other hand, as soon as they came into the shop, she would, you know, present them for sale and make sure that they were organized in the manner in which they had to be for people to view them properly. And she was terrific. And then she did all the bookkeeping. So we, you know, if someone wanted to talk about literature, they would talk to her. They want to talk about nonfiction, you know, that would be my field. So we were very, what's the word I'm looking for? Symbiotic.
Yeah, good combo.
Very, yeah.
I remember once visiting you, I think Mary was like, she was cataloging, she was doing something to put the books up onto the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Like cataloging, was that something you had to do from sort of day one? Or?
Yeah, we did that. I would write the program using FileMaker Pro, for those who know, to satisfy how we wanted to present our material on the internet. And then she would have to proofread everything that I typed because of my dyslexia. I would miss things. So she was originally, many years ago, was a professional proofreader, and she could just spot things. So she was very, very important to the business because if they relied on what I wrote, they would think this is some kind of illiterate bookseller.
Sounds like a good comment.
Right. And I looked at many, many names of bookshops, but I've never heard one said the illiterate bookseller. So she saved me from that.
Oh, neat.
So, no, and today we're still doing the same thing.
That's great.
Although she collects more books than I do, so I have to step over them a bit. But because right. Mine are, I might have 35 books, but I carry them on my iPod. Hers are on the shelves or next to the bed.
Yeah, you're good balance.
It's a good balance. It's very, very yin and yang.
All right. you mentioned going to, go to the city. Now, was it like sort of, would it be more like sort of an art gallery where a few big sales or well-to-do people would kind of carry the weight for the rest of the business? Or was it more of like just somebody happened to have a interest in a particular book and would pay maybe a few $100 for it?
Well, what we did, because we didn't have those contacts in the city to book collectors, so we would go, we would be invited to attend at a price, what are called book fairs, antiquarian book fairs, where organizers, we started the Long Island Antiquarian Book Dealers Association here on Long Island. There were a few other dealers, a few other shops at that time, and some people that were doing it from their home, sort of as a... you know, not a full-time business, but a part-time business. So they got together and said, well, we'll have an antiquarian book fair. And we had it, I think the first one was in Rockville Center about 30 years ago or more. And it worked out really well. People came. There were collectors that we never knew about here on Long Island. People from the city came. And as I was explaining, we had, you know, this is a very fertile ground for a lot of really good books here on Long Island. So when dealers like ourselves showed, some of the city dealers and collectors came out and said, oh, we haven't seen these books in years. Let's, you know, be happy to buy them. And they had, you know, customers for them. So that's what it was. And it's still that way, although there are fewer and fewer book fairs because of the internet now.
Yeah.
There have been over the years. Everything changes. If you live long enough, that's what happens.
Yeah, I was thinking about when in the last, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago now, that you have sometimes those sort of like Goodwill clothing bins that'll be near a post office or something.
Right.
And then just a few years ago, I was almost, one day, I was like, shook my head, I noticed it was like a book bin.
Right.
For used books, and it just made me think, oh my gosh, you know, what? So I was, when I was thinking about you, you know, it's like, it made me think, you know, how much are books sort of coming from an era where you started where it was like, you know, this rare thing to find, and now, you know, sometimes books are, they're like, not everywhere, but they're, you know, to some degree, they're like, how do we get rid of these things, some people?
Well, we get rid of the book as object, but we don't get rid of the printed word or, you know, material to read.
Right.
And that was the transition that started in the early, you know, mid-1990s with the advent of computers, personal computers, for, you know, when it became really expanded to people's homes. And I saw it right away in some regard that I taught myself how to make a website not too long after that for our store because I was really intrigued by it and realized that as I said a moment ago, you have to sell beyond your door. So by having a website on the internet at that time, we were selling books to England, Germany, France, wow. California, you know, so people that didn't have access to these books. And it was wonderful. Oh. And then other entrepreneurs who were much more adept at programming than I was started sites that allowed anybody or hundreds, thousands of booksellers to sell from the same site. It was called BiblioFind, and then it became ABE Books, and really opened it up to the world. So as unlike what it was prior to that, where, as I explained a moment ago, it could take weeks to sell one book through this printed journal that came out. Now you can put a book up tonight and someone anywhere in the country can find it and offer to buy it. Yeah. But what happened was it made books much more accessible and less scarce, because the only distance between the customer and the book now is a keyboard, an internet connection, and a willing to buy it. So bookshops found that it was getting to be much too expensive to pay rent and heat and employees to do what now can be done pretty much over the internet.
Yeah, the speed from the consumer angle, there's sometimes that rush of, oh, wow, I just found out about this topic or this book, and I really want to read it and like get online and look right away, and you know you can order it in a couple of days. But that's don't. Sometimes I deliberately will order a book from Barnes and Noble, and you know wait if it has to be delivered, wait a couple of weeks, pay a few extra dollars just because I like to encourage, you know, that there is a local bookstore.
Right, and that's important.
And the small publishers, I try to go to the source, you know, as much as feasible to encourage the small end, which, you know, sounds like what you do is sort of has those inroads. You're like away from the sort of big business mainstream.
Right, right. But what happens, I mean, we're living through an incredibly dramatic period of transition with regard to media, print particularly. And Amazon saw that, Amazon.com,
right,
found that books were the ideal way to start that kind of company, because it was a pretty well understood product. People knew what it was. People wanted them. It was easy to describe. And they really altered the way in which that part of the retail new book business. Well, Amazon really changed the nature in which publishers were going to be selling books. See, we didn't deal in new books. We dealt in always used, you know, antiquarian and used books. But for new books, Amazon proved that books were ideal for that kind of the market that they were aiming at.
Yeah, how does that affect you with, like, now? Because Amazon, it affects me as a small publisher. The you know, all of a sudden you can get, you know, used books for dirt cheap. Sometimes I have some of my books that were published a while ago that, you know, some of them sell for a penny.
I know.
Which totally undercuts me. But then some people, you know, try to sell them for like 50. So it's kind of wacky, but
sure.
Have you noticed that over the years?
Oh, yeah. It's you hit on something very, very important. You know, the internet, like all new technologies, is a double-edged sword. It's some bad for others. And what happened was that Amazon never really made any money at the beginning selling its books. But it was a fierce competitor as a result, and it started knocking bookshops, you know, brick and mortar bookshops out of business. They just couldn't compete with it because they were selling it at a loss or making no money at all. And Amazon realized that there are bookshops like ours all over the country that needed a broader outlet than just their own websites to sell their used, rare, and scarce books. So they opened it up to everybody. Mm-hmm. And they actually make more money when they sell one of our books than they do when they sell a new book, percentage-wise, yeah, because of the fees that they charge us. And they don't have to handle the book.
Yeah, that's a little bit.
We do all of the work. We upload all of the information. They provide the format We do the pictures. We do the mailing. We do the storing.
Yeah.
And but it works both ways. I mean, again, you know, we sell books everywhere. They bring the eye, so to speak, to
yeah.
our stock.
It's a mix.
And for new publishers, it's the same thing. As you say, you publish really nice books, and you put them out there for sale. And people can learn about them through Amazon that they're not going to learn through the little advertising you may or small publishers may or may not do. On the other hand, because everyone can be a bookseller on Amazon, you can sell from your bedroom. You don't have to have a resale number or anything. People are selling books for nickels and dimes.
Yeah.
Pennies.
So one time going to the post office, a local guy, I sort of caught wind of his conversation that he was, you know, one of those Amazon types that, you know, selling books from his home, make a few extra bucks. I have no idea whether those people, if they're making a few extra bucks or
sure.
how much it's a full business, but
right.
probably varies from place to place.
It does. And some people, you know, supplement their retirement with that. But then, you know, you and I have discussed this so over the years, but now, you know, there's been another enormous transition towards electronic books.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that I saw right away as being kind of the end of publishing as we know it and the end of book distribution as we know it. E-books will, in my belief, will eventually become the predominant
mm-hmm.
means by which people read books.
Yeah, we've had a bunch of discussions about that.
Right, and it's
yeah.
happening. You know,
yeah.
the statistics are there. And, you know, as the devices that you read, the e-readers, increase and get better, more and more, and the availability of books becomes quicker
mm-hmm.
and hopefully cheaper, as it should. That will be, in the next generation or so, the primary manner in which people will be reading books and newspapers and magazines. It makes sense. But, you know, the more books will have been published as a result of that than were when it was required to have been done on paper and ink and through publishers. Because, as you know, and this must hurt, you know, your business to some extent, anybody can publish a book now,
mm-hmm.
you know, through self-publishing.
Oh, yeah.
So in the long run, there'll be more titles available probably in the next 10 years than there were in all the history of publishing. Will they be good? Well, no, not all of them. Nor were they when the publishers published them,
yeah.
you know. I mean, we turned down more books than offered to us by individuals for purchase than we bought. And you know, publishers are, you know, produced everything.
Yeah,
good
even
and bad.
Amazon now, I think, is sort of, maybe other places are sort of taking on, it's a sort of like pseudo-publishing where it's like, oh, yeah, somebody wants to have a book, they just, Amazon can sort of, quote, publish it.
Right.
And then sell it, but it's like they didn't actually do it, you know, thing, but, you know, it looks like, oh, it was published. So it's the whole veneer of publishing has changed. Who is actually a publisher has changed, too. So.
Right. If you're correct, and I know you are, but if I'm right, I think Amazon publishes under several what are called imprints, different names.
That's the thing where it gets tricky, too. It looks
yeah.
like one way, and it's, you know, oh, it looks like it was published by so-and-so with a fancy name. And then,
exactly.
oh, that's just Amazon, and all you did was get the stamp, which is, okay, you know, I understand that.
Right.
It's a great way to get books out there, but it's just, you know, you have to look, like a lot of products, you have to look at the labels.
Bookstores are diminished in number,
yeah.
Then people turn to places like Amazon and Barnes
sure.
and Noble and books and websites to find out, well, where's the product now? And that's where it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand that in discussions with you that it's affected your business to some extent, or you're doing maybe a little bit more consulting with authors.
Oh, yeah.
And less direct publishing.
Yeah. Yeah, the book sales and distribution has been a big challenge. You know, with the lack of stores and with more people buying online and also locally as far as sort of poetry, a lot more writers publishing. So, again, there's that glut of the market which makes, you know, a book about to be, which make a book that I might publish, it just diminishes the interest. But then it's sort of ironic. It's like then on the other, balancing that, there's like more people interested in getting their book out there.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that's created a more recent shift for me into helping more people self-publish.
Right. And
they may have the niche that I wouldn't have for them.
Exactly.
But they have their own niche, so I can help them, and they're happy to take their book and sell it to, you know, wherever they can.
Exactly. So and what you bring to it are the skills that you have mm-hmm. as an editor and book designer, because most of us, you know, most people don't have that skill.
Yeah, thanks.
The authors don't. That's why they have editors, you know, and that's why, you know,
yeah.
they've had them for years and good publishers. So, I, you know, with your skills, you should be a survivor in this transition.
I appreciate the nod.
No,
yes.
It's true. It's true.
I think that's...
But if I can interject a sort of a
sure.
personal note
sure.
as to why I why the e-books appeal to me is that ever since I was a child I was dyslexic and still am, and you know I found later in life that I'm probably a little less dyslexic than many. There's a degree. There are varying degrees of dyslexia. But I never read fiction that much. Reading was always something I did for information. And unlike many of our customers who would buy bagfuls of mysteries and novels and read themselves to sleep, I couldn't do that. I would be reading nonfiction slower and more deliberately. So when the e-book came along, I found that you could read these on smaller devices. You know, you could not just your computer screen. And it turned out you could do it on what I had at the time, an iPod Touch. And to my amazement, I found that it made reading for me as a dyslexic much easier and more enjoyable. And that's been maybe 6 or 7 years ago that I learned that. And now it's been proven by people who have studied the phenomenon. So there's a benefit to it in some ways.
What is the difference that it's because it's printed words on a screen
it's interesting that you asked that because I never really paid much attention to the fact that I was dyslexic. I just knew it.
Huh.
They didn't know it when I was growing up because that was in going to public schools. That was in the 50s. So they just sort of didn't know what to do with me. But later they learned. They've studied it, they recognize it, and several of the components of it seem to be that we're easily distracted by other things on the page. For example, my wife will be reading the New York Times and have it spread out on the dining room table, and I'm reading it on my device, but I'm not distracted by all of the other print on the page that she's reading.
Oh, okay.
And another component of it, or aspect of what dyslexia seems to be, that dyslexics tend to stay away from thick books, a lot of words, and by reading on the iPod, it's the column, which is the same size as in the New York Times, that my wife is reading at the same, at the table, it scrolls up. So I don't realize how long this article is. And in the New York Times, that can often be, pretty substantial, extensive. And as long as the article kept my interest, I would just keep reading it.
Interesting.
And then I would see what it was when I looked at it. Mary was showing me, said, "Oh, did you read this?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Yeah, it's right here in the back." I look and I go, "Oh my, that was 2 pages of, columns." I never would have even thought beginning that. I could go on for a long time about it. So we sort of tend to stay away from thick books. Although when we find an author, even an author of fiction, that holds our interest, which there aren't many, but we read just about everything we can find, but at a very slow pace, much slower.
You reminded me, as a friend of mine, I consider it a brilliant, his theory is that, because say, there's like people who are dyslexic, considering that, say, Jewish people read backwards,
mm-hmm.
Chinese people read backwards or vertically. He told me once that he considered that people like reincarnated, maybe people with a dyslexic would be leaning towards, they were reading right to left in one life, and then they reborn and they're like reading left to right. So that I like that theory.
That could be. That hasn't been proven scientifically.
No,
can't rule it out.
And it probably will never be.
But
getting back to Mr. Jones, I want to hear about some of the characters or any types of people that stood out in your years at the store.
Oh, many, many, many. As a matter of fact, I was just doing a little bit. I was checking on something because, as when computers came about. I got into them as quickly as I could with the Mac. I've always been with Macintosh because everyone was telling me, oh, Michael, that's the easiest. You'll definitely love it. And it appealed to me as a dyslexic because right away, dyslexics don't spell very, very well. We don't see our mistakes. And here we had spell check, it was amazing. It was incredible. I couldn't read my own handwriting because I think I kind of hid it from the teachers that I wasn't spelling properly. So now I'm at the keyboard and I have this big screen that I can read it on. And, I took to technology. It was really interesting. And one of the things that happened is I won this video camera through the local Rotary Club every year. They'd come in and we would buy a raffle ticket. I think it was $50 to, you know, help them in all the good work that they did. And after, I don't know how many years of doing this, one day a fellow walks in that I know and he says, Michael, you won something finally. I said, oh, what's that? He said, oh, a video camera. And thanked him very much, brought it home, tried to figure out what do you do with it, and it occurred to me that we used to have poetry readings in the store. And local poets would ask us, and, you know, we had some space because we opened up the downstairs. And we did, and we found that it was a lot of work on the part of the poet and on us, and you would get not that many readers. I mean, not that many people in the audience. And then I saw this video camera and figured it out because of the Mac comes with, for those of you who have had Macs, know that it came with a thing called iMovie. And it was a, you know, an editing program. And it took me less than 24 hours to figure out how to do it and get it up on the internet. Yeah. Well, I sort of took to it. And I started, as you know, that's how we met, this thing called Poetry Vlog.
Yeah, that's a good segue. You have online video. For people who don't know, it's a video poetry series that Michael started with George Wallace, who's the first Suffolk County Poet Laureate on Long Island. And, I was one of the first batch filmed in your store before the store was closed, and now how many poets are up there?
I don't, you know, I've lost,
like
lost
a couple
count
hundred,
specifically.
Right?
Well, it's about 100, and, I say more than 150. I'll have to count pretty soon. And we were doing it weekly. You know, I was very enthusiastic. First, I thought I'd do one every day. my eyes were bigger than my abilities at that point. And then we went to once a week. And then after, you know, we closed the shop, I didn't have that much, strangely enough, that much time to devote to it. And now it's kind of once, on occasion, it's occasional once a month or so.
The Poetry Vlog. Poetry, the word poetry, the letter VLOG.com, right?
Right, yeah. Okay. Instead of a blog, it's V for video.
Video
so
log,
yeah. Yeah, so it's Vlog. And that's where we met. And it's interesting because I take to new ideas sometimes and, you know, try to fulfill their potential as much as I'm capable of doing. And one of our most interesting authors was in the store one day, someone I had known since birth here in Port Jefferson, Jesse Ball, B-A-L-L, who just had a really nice review of his latest book in the New York Times, just 2 days ago, I think. And we had a book signing for him because of who he was, and, you know, a friend of his book, March Book. And shortly after that, when I had the video, I said, you know, Jesse, could you do me a favor? I said, what's that? He said, well, I really like one of the poems in your book, and could I get you to read it? I'm working on this concept of having poets on video. And he said, yeah. So he was our first one. And it's really very a pleasure for me to have videoed him first because he is someone who will be known in the literary world for years and years to come.
Yeah, I saw on City Lights books, the website, there was one of his new book on their main page.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember hearing about him, and, you know, it's interesting. So that's interesting. Which, a couple of things that brings up. One, the sort of industry-wise, I know Ferlinghetti and whoever he started, I forgot the guy's name, who started City Lights with, that was at the time when, you know, paperbacks were just coming in, you know, to view.
Exactly.
And so they like kind of hit that market when it was starting. It just makes me think about the whole industry and, you know, the way life changes. And a lot of it is just, you know, timing in what you're doing that you kind of are there at that point where something shifts. And And you, you know, quite interesting that you, you know, you go from your back to the past to present and future. You like go and span back antiquarian. You also win this video camera and you start, you know, going fast forward into the future. So,
right.
Well, you know, a book time traveler.
Well, I appreciate that, but I tend to think that way. Maybe it's my, you know, my training in sociology to see the bigger picture. You know, I understood a long time ago that opportunity is nothing if you don't see it for what it can be. Mm-hmm. You know, and for example, you know, one of my heroes is Steven Jobs.
Okay.
Because he saw things. He would look at a computer in a way that others weren't looking at him. He looked at him in terms of not only function, but design. And think about that, how he changed, you know, that whole world of computing, just in terms of the look as well as the functionality of it. And, yeah, so I try to take advantage of that. To go back to, you know, we knew Ferlinghetti's bookshop,
City Lights,
when we were living in Berkeley and just before that in San Francisco. And those booksellers, Cody was one in Berkeley, Fred Cody, Kepler's in Palo Alto, and Ferlinghetti, when they started selling books, they wanted publishers to be able to sell them paperbacks. And the publishers wouldn't do it. This is back in the late 50s, early 60s. The publishers were selling paperbacks, what they called pocketbooks, in bus stops. Who knows what a bus stop is? A terminal, you know, like Greyhound, or in airports and in drugstores. They were on these wire racks, and they would hire these artists to write these really racy-looking covers for a Colette novel, you know. to attract the passerby. Oh, you know, I'll buy this for 35 cents. And they were distributed to bookshops like Cody's and City Lights and Kepler's through the magazine distributors, periodical distributors. But they were 35 cents.
Yeah, that's amazing.
You couldn't make any money. And then the newspaper periodical distributors, which had shady reputations, to put it politely, would insist that in order to get the books, they had to have the girly magazines or this magazine. And those people, particularly Cody and Kepler's, pushed really, really hard. This is post-World War II. Universities are booming with new students, older students coming back from World War II, taking advantage of the GI Bill. And there was a real market for good quality paperbacks at reasonable prices, something similar to what...
Modern sales, like online?
Yeah, a Modern Library. Okay. Modern Library came out with, the publishers of Modern Library came out with inexpensive hardcovers that were being sold in colleges. And colleges and universities had this, were building up this demand for good quality publishing in paper. And these three booksellers particularly pushed and pushed and pushed and finally got publishers to recognize it. And create at affordable prices good quality paperbacks at a price that people could afford and booksellers could afford to sell. And that happened in my lifetime. I didn't even know it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like I thought one of the first, I remember going into your store, you know, I had lived in Colorado for some years, and that was probably my first introduction. There was a shop called Poor Richards.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, it was like, wow, all these used books. Little paperbacks and poetry and all kinds of esoteric stuff, whatever. It was like stuff that I'd never heard of.
Exactly.
And you could find stuff that wasn't just like being promoted, that just happened to be current. So I remember, you know, a few times in your store, that just that kind of smell of the store and the wood floors. And, you know, I do miss that. It's nice as it is to find something on Amazon now. It lacks that atmosphere.
Exactly. You know, and I've always thought of it in those terms. That, you know, to quote Dylan, we may not have what you need, but we probably have what you want. And in a way, that's what an antiquarian bookshop, used bookshop, is all about. You hit it. You appreciate what we were aiming at.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go in there and you could spend time looking and saying, I didn't even know these books were printed.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I can handle them, take them off the shelf, go through them, see if they strike my interests, and if they do, I can get it.
Yeah, who knows?
Whereas libraries, you couldn't even do that sometimes at university libraries. Mm-hmm. If you were an undergraduate, I know in the Berkeley system, if you're an undergraduate and you weren't on the honors list, you have this massive library, but you would go through the card catalog, submit the request for the book. They'd have runners, and your number would come up on this big board, and they would bring the book to you in a day or two, if not right away. And for those of us who were honor students, we got to go into the stacks. They let us. So we'd be going in there. We're doing research on, you know, just undergraduate work. But what we're looking at, what we have access to. My fellow students didn't even know these books existed. So I was pulling books off the shelf, looking, reading them, going through them, you know, taking what I needed from them for my research, and graduated with honor. I mean, I wasn't brilliant. I had access.
Yeah, maybe those days will come back. I mean, if it's possible, it just got me thinking, you know, hey, so I got a bunch of books laying around, and poetry books I'm looking to get rid of, just space-wise. But maybe someday someone will, you know, will say, hey, there's no used bookstores. I got all these books.
Right.
Let's open one.
Well, the person, the people, the company, whatever, that does that, replicates that electronically, will make a fortune if they want to charge for it, but will be doing civilization a great service. If they can duplicate that experience, and, you know, like Google is scanning in hundreds of thousands of books and content, and I think that's great. You can look up a book. Yeah. If they can make it so that you can search it by just about anything, not only title and author, year or publisher and subject and even words on a page. And I think they'll be able to do that electronically.
Interesting.
And if you're looking for a sort of an esoteric word or something or a phrase, they can find that in the book and say, well, here's one that was published in 1822.
And sometimes I remember one of the first things on the computer when I started to web search, I don't even think they do it anymore. It seemed to disappear. It was like highlighted pages.
Yeah.
Like I would look up, I'd be looking up, you know, some topic, and there would be a paragraph within a page with exact bit that I wanted highlighted, and I haven't seen that. I think it disappeared. I don't know what happened.
And they really have to bring that back to reproduce in a modern way the experience that you had as a customer in a used bookshop that you just eloquently stated, and to satisfy the experience that we had creating that, you know, making that possible as bookshop owners.
No,
it'll happen. I think it will happen.
Interesting.
Mac computer, if I can just have something up in the right-hand corner that you can search. And you just type in a word. So you can type in the word pencil. It'll show me everything on my computer that has the word pencil. Doesn't matter where it is. Yeah. I have 6 hard drives. You know. And I tried it once. It was pretty amazing.
You definitely have an inquiring mind.
I like
that about you. So I don't know why, but I'm just like itching to hear, like, is there some guy, like, you know, that come into the store and be like, I'm looking for Alfred Lord Tennyson's first book of poetry that he spilled coffee on, and I will pay you $500.
No, that's more in the,
oh,
in
just,
the,
I've,
in
I've
the
seen
novels.
Too,
that's I've, more in the novels about used books.
I watch too much TV as
yeah,
a kid.
Right.
No, there's nothing like that.
No, I mean, we just had funny stories. I mean, we had good customers and really wonderful ones. And what always amazed me, first of all, we didn't sell much to undergraduates because we did absolutely nothing with textbooks, you know, hardcover textbooks. We would deal in scholarly and scarce books and scholarly titles, but not those that were assigned for Lit 101 or something like that.
Right.
But our biggest customer base were the graduate students.
Oh, okay.
In all fields. You know, even physics and math, if we got really good books. But they weren't just textbooks. They were classics in their field that they either wanted to read or had to read before they completed their degrees, their highest degrees. And so what was interesting is that the graduate students and those who were collectors who focused in on a particular field, they would come into the shop, they'd go right to the section that they were looking for, and within seconds almost, they would see the latest addition to that section.
Oh, yeah,
it was just uncanny how they did that, you know. They'd go over, and 5 minutes later, they'd come back with 3 or 4 books. Oh, you just put these out.
That's the thing. You hit the nail on the head, because my limited experience, I sort of got into collecting haiku books. because I started reading, and then I'd say, oh, this looks good, and I learned a bunch, and then people started giving me book haiku books, and so it's to the point there, if a certain haiku book on some rare thing shows up, I get like, wow, I get that interest that you're describing.
Great.
That somebody, you know, yeah. I think that's the draw of a store, like, you know, like the kind of thing you do, you know, that someone who has an interest in a topic, you know, then they specifically, they're interested in whether it's deep learning or just trivia, they want to enhance, you know, all they know about that topic.
Right, and they're terrific, too, because what they're doing is they're putting, like, people like yourself who are collecting books on haiku or whatever their interests are, they're putting together collections that no one else will have.
Yeah,
And they'll know more about that subject in one or two ways than others. You know, they may be doing it just as a history of the publishing on that subject. Not so much, you know, they're not scholars of the content necessarily. There's a place called the Grolier Club.
Does the book publisher Grolier?
No, well, Grolier was, but this is the Grolier Club. That was Collier.
Oh, okay.
This is Grolier in New York City on 57th, 58th Street. Very, very small place, and it is made up of and sustained by book collectors. And they have unbelievable exhibits there. I mean, exhibits of really, really remarkable tomes. And most of them come from their members. And they're delighted to show them. So anyone in your audience who's anywhere near New York City, look up the Grolier Club. It's open to the public. It costs nothing to go in. And there are three floors, small. You know, it was a brownstone. Beautiful bookcases, glass enclosed exhibits. And it's just remarkable.
Yeah, I want to make sure we get people that might, you know, contact you, because who knows who has some kind of book. It's goodtimesbookshop.com, right?
Yeah, the goodtimesbookshop.com. That's correct.
Excellent. And any other info? We got a few minutes, a little bit more time. Anything else you want to highlight about, you know, anything that you're looking for books or any kind of, you know?
Yeah, customers. Or as we used to say, people say, wow, that's really a rare book. And I'd say, yeah, but the customer's more rare than the book.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
No, we're doing all right.
That's good. That's
but
good.
We'll always have more books. I mean, you've been to our house. You know it's filled with books. We have an office filled with books. We have a storage unit filled with books. And, you know, we love books, and we love having them around. But, you know, people are doing really interesting things with books now. I don't know if you've noticed what artists are doing.
Tell me.
They're reformatting them. They're reforming them as sculptures.
Hmm.
They're using them for paintings, backdrops, for canvases. You take rows and rows. I've seen this. There's a thing called Book Patrol that I get every day on the internet, and I subscribe to. And they're always talking about, you know, new ways in which books are being used. And artists are doing the most phenomenal things with them.
Like sculptures with the books.
I saw one where the fellow took a bookcase, and he painted as if that was the canvas. And you could see the image that the artist was presenting, but you could also see that it was on the spines of books. Really amazing.
That sounds really novel.
Yeah. And making furniture out of them. They're making, they've had this for years, making little stash boxes. You know, they cut out the pages and the interior, and then you just close the book. So when it's on its side, you raise it up, and you have a little hidden compartment there. That's been done for years, but now they're doing it in a more artistic way. Yeah, look up the art of the book now, or the art and the book.
The
internet, and you'll see what they're doing. It's just a phenomenal process. Because, you know, books as objects are becoming, you know, to sum up kind of what we've been talking about, books as objects and not just information are in need of transformation because people don't want them. Our neighbor today emailed and said, Michael, what do I do with these books?
Mm-hmm.
I said, I really don't have a good suggestion for you.
A new doorstop company or something.
Well, doorstops.
You reminded me of one of the funny, there was a Seinfeld episode where Kramer gets an idea to make a coffee table book about coffee tables.
Well, that's what they're doing. That's right. He got it.
I got another question. Sure. While we're doing the funny stuff, I got to read. There's another stanza in the Dylan song. I'm going to play that song to go out with the outro for the show. but because you have a good sense of humor, and sometimes Dylan is deep, and sometimes I think he's just writing whatever comes to mind.
Right.
And this is a perfect stanza in that. Now you see this one-eyed midget shouting the word now, and you say, for what reason? And he says, how? And you say, what does this mean? And he screams back, you're a cow. Give me some milk or else go home, because there's something happening here, but you don't know what it is. Mr.
Do you, Mr. Jack? Right. Dylan is so playful mm-hmm. in his language and his rhyming, and yet it's profound when he's finished with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Twyla Tharp did something about that, you know, the dance choreographer.
I've heard of her. I don't know what she
did. She did a wonderful program, a dance program on Dylan, and the times they are changing, taken from the name of one of his mm-hmm. early songs. And I flew out to San Diego to see it. Mary and I went out. We were really excited. And it was different than I thought, because she saw the playfulness in his words and the circus quality of what he did. And after about 20 minutes, I settled back in my chair and I said, this, she is brilliant to have seen that when most people didn't in Dylan. We saw the politics. We saw the poetry. But there is, as you pointed out, this great use of words, of language.
Yeah, not always having to know what it means. I know he read a lot of poetry, and writers don't always know what the heck they're doing.
He's a sponge.
Yeah, he's amazing. I mean, could do a whole. Yeah, we could talk for.
Oh, sure.
Get too sidetracked. Yeah, reminded. There's a Robert Frost. I think I read this. Somebody asked him, you know, the that famous poem that ends, "Miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep."
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's true, but I read something where somebody asked him, you know, what was the reason he came up with that? And what was he trying to do by repeating the line? And, you know, all these explanations. And I think his answer was, I couldn't think of anything else.
Right. Exactly. You know, why are you asking me these questions, you know? Or, you know, some people say, what pencil do you write with? You know, like that's going to make them a better, writer, because they use the same pencil. You know?
One with lead.
Right.
So are you still doing, because you did, you helped me when I decided to put my poems into a video. You filmed and I watched, I sat there and helped you edit. We edited it online. Are you still doing the editing?
To make stuff?
So that's another side business you have.
Another side business, yeah. And I enjoy it, and I certainly enjoyed doing it with you. That was very creative. And we did it literally on a shoestring budget.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know,
yeah.
Don't throw any of those DVDs away. You watch.
Yeah.
You watch.
Who knows?
Yeah. So. People will see them. And go,
yeah, it is.
That's
it is
pretty
neat.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It is.
Thanks for doing the poetry videos. It's I know it's like when it just started. It's kind of amazing. Wow. You know, we can be online. Poets can be online and have their works. I think for whatever craft, you know, it serves a function. And also for poetry, it animates it. And I find once I've heard somebody read poetry, it's never the same. Then when I read a book of theirs, I can hear their voice.
Exactly.
and it makes it better. And,
exactly.
I mean, not that I don't like people I have
right.
never heard, but it does,
yeah.
it does. It's nice to hear the voice after when you read the words.
Right, and you and I and George and the other poets saw that and appreciated it, and that was before YouTube. Think of that.
Wait, you're saying that when you first videoed the vlog, that's before
pre-YouTube.
I don't even remember when YouTube starts.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things
yeah.
that, wow.
Take a look.
That's
and phenomenal. Then, and you know, and I just, because I used to tell people, I said, look, if I can do this, you can do it.
Yeah.
I just got a Macintosh in this little handheld video.
Right.
And if you're willing to spend an evening learning how to use the software that's already on your computer and the interest enough to do it, you can do it. And you know how many videos they put up on YouTube a day?
Oh, yeah.
600,000.
Yeah, it's
you know?
Wow.
So that, you know, you were right there in the forefront of
it. Oh, hey, neat.
And you see the purpose. We might get 20,000 hits on mm-hmm. a poet.
Amazing.
Or on the site. Now, you can't get that when you read poetry.
You can't get if you get a dozen people, you know.
Exactly, or 100 or 500.
Yeah.
It's really popular, you know.
Yeah.
But it's all over the world, and it doesn't matter. You can be in, you know, literally in Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have internet connection, you can see Monk.
Or,
isn't that great?
Oh, no, don't get me too excited.
Yeah,
so.
I can actually track it. I can tell you from
right.
where in the world your poems are being, or your pages at least, where your poetry is, on the, is being viewed from. So, yeah, it's pretty, well, that's the NSA part, you know.
Well, who knows, you know, or it's just a bunch of robots, like 5,000 robots have watched my poems.
No, I don't think so.
So, kind of to wrap it up, like anything
sure.
you think, you know, where do you think things are going, you know, where do you think things are at or going as far as
I think
publishing and
I think they're going
digital?
A pot. I think they're going to pot, and I'm all for it.
What do you mean? Say as far as...
Go to Colorado.
No, I've been there. I've been there, done that. So.
No, but the pot in Colorado.
Oh, I see.
I'm trying to...
It's a little joke there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they're going to pot in New York now, too.
That's happening.
On medical marijuana.
Yeah, it's a crack
thing,
in
you know,
the
where things
farmer.
Are going, we don't know. But I look at it, and I welcome the future.
Yeah.
But we have to be able to harness it for good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I know you work on all the time with your mind and your writing, and others do. And others are just out there trying to, you know, rape the earth and take all of its resources without, you know, being mindful of it. So people like us have to fight against that. But change is going to happen. Change is inevitable. The longer you live, the more everything you knew changes. And that's, you know, we live on a revolving planet, a recycling planet. That's the nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree?
Oh, wow, that's a deep question there. I mean, that's a whole...
Well, the house I'm sitting in right now isn't going to be here in 1,000 years.
Yeah, that's a whole...
Neither am I, and, you know,
yeah, it's
might
like,
be...
There's, I guess there, yeah, that, I mean, that gets into a whole philosophical section of, you know, the things that, staying true to the things that are kind of, quote, timeless, or, you know, that's a whole, again, a whole, like, part of me likes to stay connected with as much of the, what I would call the eternal, while dealing with the everyday world and the change of things, so.
Right, well, we're part of both.
Yeah, yeah, so,
we will be recycled.
That's...
one way or another, seriously. We will be, you know. The ants and the worms can have me, that's fine. They need to eat too, you know.
Well, on that cheery note, it's not uncheery, it's just a real...
No, it's not. Yeah. It's part of life.
But I think,
it is.
You touched on a lot of the deep topic of what, you know, again, is the technology can be used, you know, in an abusive way or... You know, it is connecting like a lot of indigenous peoples around the world that are really on the forefront of trying to protect the earth and the, and you know, to be able to get online and see someone in Alaska or Siberia or Arizona, you know, stand there and say, you know, we need to protect the water or the mountain. I mean, that's where the human element cuts through the technology. So I hope that that's got to keep on.
And it gives voice to everybody.
Yeah. All right, well,
good or bad, but it gives voice to everybody, and that's kind of, that's nice. I think in the long run, we do better than we do worse,
all right.
At least in my lifetime.
All right, well, yeah, good luck.
But we have to fight for it all the time.
Hmm.
Never ends. Great to be invited onto your show.
Thank
Best of luck with it.
Thank you. Good luck with all your projects.
Well, thank you.
All right, take care, Michael.
You too, Mike. Bye-bye.
And we'll go out with the aforementioned Ballad of a Thin Man by Bob Dylan. And some of you remember used bookstores, while some of you remember LP albums. So ironically, this is off of YouTube, but it's a vinyl rip recording. Ticket.
but he hears you speak and says, how does it feel to be such a freak? And you say, impossible, as he hands you a bone. And something is happening here, but you don't know what it is.
Something is happening and you don't know what it is.